You're listening to another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A deep dive into a classic show whose influence is immeasurable. Your next stop, Anthology. Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast where I review The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer, another classic and contemporary science fiction anthology series. For archives of all of my episodes, visit anthologypod.com. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod and follow me on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod. And if you'd like to support what I do here, you can become a patron at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer, where you can get access to exclusive B-roll episodes, TV and book reviews, movie reaction recordings, commentary tracks, early access to podcast episodes, just a whole bunch of stuff. And I recently included a new tier for that. It's on a tiered system. So if you want just science fiction related content, you can go to the $4 per month sci-fi exclusive content. So on that particular feed, on that particular tier, I have an immediate reaction recording of my thoughts on Black Mirror Season 6, which runs for about 2 hours, just shy of 2 hours, an hour and 50 minutes, where I basically give my literally immediate reaction to each individual episode. I spend about 20, 25 minutes on each episode of Season 6 of Black Mirror, you know, ahead of doing my bonus episode series that's going to be forthcoming very soon, on the main feed. So that, I also have an ongoing read-along review series of the Expanse book series, the space opera, the nine-book space opera series by James S.A. Corey. That I have mapped out for 56 episodes. I've completed 20 of them so far. Basically, I'm taking each book of this nine-book series and breaking it up into six Patreon recordings per book, plus two for the short fiction collection. So it's a nine book series, six episodes, plus two for the short fiction collection, 56 episodes total. I'm currently on book four. So if you want to join Patreon and read along with me and read my thoughts as I read through each book of the Expanse series, I have 20 episodes up there now, as of right now, and I'm going to be continuing that throughout the rest of the year. And then the goal is that next year I'll be doing episode reviews of the TV series. So again, that's at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. We have all the different tiers, you know, mapped out and everything. So again, I do have that special science fiction tier that's just for sci-fi related stuff at the $4 per month level. So consider checking that out. And like I said, I do have that immediate reaction recording of Black Mirror Season 6 posted right now. So if you're listening to this right now, like the moment that I press, you know, publish on the episode, Patreon has access to that Black Mirror immediate reaction. So anyway, that's my pitch for Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Once again, I'm Matt. Thank you guys so much for joining me to talk about the season 3 finale of The Twilight Zone. So today on the show, I'm going to be discussing The Changing of the Guard, which, as I said, is the 37th and final episode of The Twilight Zone's third season. It originally aired on June 1st, 1962, and of course, I'll be rounding out the episode with a brief non-spoiler review of Science Fiction Theater Season 2, Episode 4. Episode title is The Green Bomb, which I have a link in the show notes to where you can find that online. There's a Daily Motion link and a YouTube link, so you can watch that and then listen to the review. But before I get into all of that, I do have some notes and everything from the world of fiction and science, which is the section of the podcast where I basically talk about anything science fiction related that has been kind of crossing over my brain since the last episode. And I do have to apologize. I'm sorry that there has been such a delay with getting an episode out, especially this monumental, like, season 3 end episode. This is a big milestone for me, and I've dragged my feet. I've just had a whole bunch of stuff going on, so I'm glad that I'm finally back and I'm doing this, and I have some really fun stuff planned for the interim between season 3 and season 4 of The Twilight Zone and, by extension, this podcast. So I'm excited to be back. This is just such a treat. I love doing this podcast. So anyway, from the world of fiction and science, the aforementioned Black Mirror Season 6, I am going to be covering that show extensively, all five episodes in a bonus episode review series very soon. Again, on Patreon, if you want to get my immediate thoughts on each individual episode, you can go onto Patreon, get access to that. This season of Black Mirror, if you have followed along this podcast, you know that Black Mirror is one of my favorite shows. Black Mirror indirectly is the reason why I, you know, was attracted to the Twilight Zone and pulled myself into getting into a podcast to cover the Twilight Zone and other science fiction anthology shows. So Black Mirror is kind of the genesis of that. Black Mirror season 6 is a mixed bag for the most part. There's one episode that just blew me away. It was absolutely fantastic. There were two episodes that I don't know. I there were moments where I was like, what show am I even watching? Like, is this, like, how is this Black Mirror? And then the other two episodes were pretty good, were pretty solid. Actually above average, I would even go so far as to say. So suffice it to say, I worked through a lot of my immediate thoughts on Patreon, but I'm very excited to dig into these five episodes for the podcast proper, and really just dig into it and figure out, like, my feelings on each individual episode. Like, the bonus episode series that I do for Black Mirror are some of my favorite podcast stuff that I do of any podcast that I do. So I'm excited to dig into that. But again, Patreon, you know the pitch. So the next thing that I would kind of want to talk about briefly is some movies, science fiction related movies that have come out and are about to come out that I just wanted to kind of comment on. The Flash came out a couple of weeks ago. I saw it. The Flash is one of the most interesting comic book like characters from my tastes because of the characters close proximity to science fiction, obviously time travel, the Speed Force, all of this stuff. And the Flash movie deals with that pretty well, but it's also this like in this like last bastion of the DCEU as it's about to switch over to the DCU, and it's kind of a muddled mess in some parts. Plus there's all the controversy with Ezra Miller behind the scenes and everything. It was okay. It was fine. I have an immediate reaction on Patreon for that, of course. A couple other things. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. That is coming out this weekend. If you're listening to this the week of release. I got to see a press screening of it a couple of weeks ago, and it wasn't that good, honestly. It was very subpar in my opinion. I do count Raiders of the Lost Ark to be one of the near perfect adventure films, like all told, like adventure film. Like that is one of the most perfect movies for that genre. And everything has been kind of diminishing returns from that, obviously. I do have a slight soft spot for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but I do appreciate that that movie tried to go for the 50s sci-fi aesthetic. But I do love Last Crusade. But anyway, Dial of Destiny is the kind of last hurrah of Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. He does a good job. He's fine in it. The rest of the story around it goes into some very interesting sci-fi elements. That's all I'll say about that. But in the kind of overall packaging of the movie, just it feels very lifeless and doesn't really, like, there are connections that there are elements of the movie that they introduce some elements to, like Indiana Jones as a character and some of his compatriots in this movie, and they don't follow through on them really almost at all. It's a bizarre movie in that there are elements that are introduced early in the movie that feel like they're going to tie together at the end, but then they're kind of just dropped almost entirely, or they're very softly like referenced. And I think that with the with the plot that this movie has, with that the Dial of Destiny has, I feel like there could have been a lot more interesting characterization and character arcs to be made with this, but it's not it's just not. So that's my little capsule review of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. I had an immediate reaction on Patreon as well. We may cover it on Obsessive Viewer. I don't know if we will or not. That's kind of, that podcast is kind of a nebulous thing where it's like, okay, if I have time, I'll do this, and if I can get the guests together, I can do this and everything. But anyway, that's that. But speaking of Obsessive Viewer and episodes that I have done with Obsessive Viewer, and science fiction as well, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse came out. I reviewed it on Obsessive Viewer. Really, really loved that movie. It's not as good as Into the Spider-Verse from like 5 years ago, I think. But it does some very interesting things with that whole multiverse premise. There's some fun Easter eggs. And as much as I kind of hate to say it, it does feel like part one of a two-part story, which is fine. But I also, it is also an interesting departure from Into the Spider-Verse. So that's what I'll say. It's really good. I liked it. And then to not round out because I have one more thing, but, in addition to that, recently Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 came out, incredibly heartfelt. The level of care that's given to those characters that we've been with through three Guardians movies, a holiday special, and one or two Avengers movies has been fantastic, or three, I don't know. But anyway, that's a great concluding chapter for that trilogy and everything. And there are several points in that movie that feel like if James Gunn didn't directly draw inspiration from the Twilight Zone directly, it's just like then it's just something that's baked into the DNA of this movie. So like there's a whole excursion in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 where they go to a planet that the entire premise of that planet, the entire concept of that planet feels like it feels like a Twilight Zone episode, like 145%. It feels like a Twilight Zone episode. So I just really love and admire Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 for that care that it gives. The final thing I'm going to say about movies and everything in terms of science fiction is that Oppenheimer is coming out soon, here in like a week or two, I think. I'm very curious about that. I'm a little off the Christopher Nolan train. I didn't like Tenet, and I feel like Interstellar, I still feel like is just wasn't enough for me. As much as I was a huge fan of, you know, his Batman trilogy, and Memento was one of my first like favorite like movies, like that was like my, oh, movies can be, you know, movies aren't just big budget movies. That was because I was a kid then. But anyway, but Oppenheimer is something that I'm very intrigued about. I love Cillian Murphy. I'm loving that this is going to be his first like starring role, like center role and everything. And I just love that he's doing that. Well, not for starring role, but for starring role in a Christopher Nolan movie. Like he's number one on the call sheet on Oppenheimer, and that's so exciting because I love that dude as an actor. He is phenomenal. So that's what I have to say about movies and everything. Books, I read Homo Deus by Yuval Noah Harari. It's this book about kind of speculation on where the human race, Homo sapiens, are going to go in the future. There's some really interesting stuff there. It's not as good as his other book, Sapiens, and I'm working on reading 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. I just started that last night, which is like he's a kind of historian and he speculates about the future of the species and everything. He's a gifted writer and everything. And he has some very good ideas, and Homo Deus was pretty good. Check out, you know, my review on Goodreads and stuff like that. But anyway, that's it for that. Also, this is a thing. Recording this, I am now 37. Today is my birthday. I'm recording this on my 37th birthday, and that's a little freaky. It's a little it's a little freaky. I didn't know 37 was a number, much less a number that I would live toward. That's kind of bleak. I didn't mean it like that, but it's just, it's crazy. I'm in my late 30s. That's crazy. I don't know. A couple other things. One, I also celebrated my 10-year anniversary of the first time I ever posted or recorded a podcast episode. On June 15th, 2013, Tiny and I recorded our first ever episode of Obsessive Viewer, and it's been 10 years since, and I've posted over 1,000 recordings of my voice onto the internet over the course of 3 podcasts, guest appearance on podcasts, and Patreon, that whole just mess of stuff. So very, very happy with myself, very excited for that milestone. And thank you guys for following along in any capacity. If you're listening to this, you're supporting me and supporting this passion that I have for podcasting. And I can't thank you guys enough. So thank you so much. And then speaking of thank yous, last thing before I get into the actual review, I got a very nice listener email from Donna. It's been a couple of months now. I need to respond to her. I'm so sorry, Donna, if you're listening, but by the time you're listening to this, you should have a reply in your inbox. But I really appreciated the email. You guys can email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Any thoughts on the stuff that I cover and everything, any just chat. It's great to get emails and everything. But anyway, I'm going to read part of the email just because she took the time to write me, and I was really, really appreciative of this email. So Donna writes, "First of all, I wanted to say I'm a new listener to the podcast and a big fan already. After many years of watching Twilight Zone, I can't recall my first impressions to an episode, so it's refreshing to hear a first-time viewer's perspective. A perfect example is Young Man's Fancy. Not being a favorite, I hadn't given it the consideration it deserved. Seeing it through your eyes was like, wow, this is a really great episode." I'm going to stop here and just say that is like the highest compliment, because I'm coming at this, I've said for years now at this point, and over 100 episodes at this point of the main feed of Anthology, that I am a first-time viewer. I am someone who is experiencing all of this for the first time. So just the idea that my opinion, my immediate reaction, my initial first impression of an episode can, you know, help people have, or can even cause people to not even change their opinions, but reconsider certain aspects of the thing that they've watched for years of their life, while I'm coming at it as a newbie, is just incredibly flattering, and I'm so happy about that. So thank you so much. She goes on to write, "As for the marathons, we have a Twilight Zone watch party and a New Year's Eve tradition for many years. Who wants to go out and party when you can watch Twilight Zone for 3 days straight? Having just done that, kind of like doing the Twilight Zone marathon thing in my limited capacity," this is me talking now, this past New Year's, it was a religious experience for me. So she continues, "There's something very special about watching the marathon, knowing that millions of other people are watching the same episodes at the same time. It's just not the same as a solo view in my book." Totally agree. And then a couple other things that Donna says is, "I can't wait to hear your review and thoughts on two of the most compelling episodes in my mind. In fact, they are back-to-back episodes in season 5. I Am the Night, Color Me Black. Talk about lots to unpack in this episode. Then The Masks, arguably one of my favorite people get their just desserts of the whole series," which I like. I'm aware of some things with The Masks, and I'm very excited for that one too. And then she concludes by saying, "I'm also looking forward to listening to your reviews of episodes I've been like meh in the past, although there are a few I will never change my mind on. Example, I Sing the Body Electric, puke emoji, haha." And that is so interesting to me, because if you guys listened to my I Sing the Body Electric episode, I felt like I was kind of not bamboozled by it, but I was just kind of, I came to that episode thinking that it was like a big episode. I thought that was going to be like a huge, like a big, like great episode of the Twilight Zone canon. And I was surprised that it was just so underwhelming. I think I was pretty kind to it in my review. I don't really remember all that well, but I do think that I was a little surprised at how just not really that good that episode was. So yeah. Anyway, so thank you so much, Donna, for reaching out and everything. And I'm so glad that you're a new listener and that you're enjoying the show. And once again, to everyone listening, since I'm in this nostalgic state, that is also kind of fitting for the content of this episode that I'm reviewing. But since I'm in such a nostalgic state, just thank you guys so much for supporting the podcast. If this is the only one of my podcasts that you listen to, I still cannot tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you're willing to let me be in your ears for an hour, hour and a half, however infrequently I record these podcasts and everything. But just the fact that you're giving so much of your time to me for this little project and this passion that I have is just incredibly, I cannot state how grateful I am for that. So thank you guys so much. And once again, you can reach me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com and all the social medias and stuff. But anyway, so thank you guys. And let's go in to this episode. So again, I'm going to be reviewing The Changing of the Guard. And as is customary with this podcast, I need to share what I knew before the episode. And I didn't know really anything. And in fact, it's funny because there's an element to this episode that I didn't even realize until I was almost done with the episode, which I'll get to in my review. But what I knew before, or what I assumed beforehand, is that judging from the title, it made me think of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery and how there's this ceremonial changing of the guard. I kind of thought that maybe, like, that's a literal read of the title, obviously, so maybe it had something to do with that. And it's funny because I don't even know when that tradition started, so I don't know if that predates the Twilight Zone or postdates it, but I don't know. But anyway, the other thought that I had was that maybe this episode had something to do with, like, a kind of, I don't know, if it was kind of a lost style thing, where maybe this episode would be about transferring some kind of supernatural or mystical guard duty over to a new guard. That was another kind of thought that I had. And then finally, I thought that maybe it's another episode about aging, which to an extent, it kind of is. So those were my kind of just random thoughts before watching The Changing of the Guard. So now I'm going to go ahead and read the plot summary of the episode, courtesy of The Twilight Zone, Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic by Martin Grahams Jr. Of course, this is where I'm going to start spoiling this episode, so every facet of this episode is going to be spoiled. So if you haven't watched it and you don't want to be spoiled, go watch it and then come back. It's on Paramount Plus. I guess it's also on Freevee, which I think is accessible through Amazon Prime Video, I think. I was kind of surprised to see that. But anyway, check it out and then come back. So here we go. Spoilers on for The Changing of the Guard, and here's the plot summary, courtesy of Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic by Martin Grahams Jr. On the final day of the first semester, just days before the Christmas holiday at the Rock Springs School for Boys, Professor Fowler is delivered a notice of termination. A member of the faculty for more than 50 years, the board considers him a teacher of incalculable value. As it must come to all men, youth must be served, a changing of the guard. Professor Fowler, however, feels he is an abject failure, an aging relic on deaf young ears. He never accomplished anything with his poetry. In his final moments in the classroom alone, Professor Fowler contemplates suicide when he is visited by the specters of those who were once his students. After a brief discussion with the ghosts of his past, the professor learns that each of his students was a fine young man who left his mark on society. It was through his teaching that the boys learned about courage, loyalty, ethics, and honesty. The professor hears their stories and realizes he was wrong when he stated that he moved nobody, motivated nobody, and left no imprint. He was by their elbows from the moment they left his classroom. Content with this knowledge, Professor Fowler is grateful for the time he had to teach the youth, and now looks forward to a future of promising contentment. So, starring as Professor Ellis Fowler is Donald Pleasance. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone. He did appear in one episode of One Step Beyond in 1961, season three's episode The Confession. And he was in one episode of The Outer Limits, season one's The Man with the Power in 1963. And then finally, he was in one episode of The Ray Bradbury Theater, which aired in season two in 1988, Punishment Without Crime. And of course, Donald Pleasance is best known to me as Dr. Sam Loomis in the Halloween franchise. He also appeared as Blofeld and Bond, and he was also in The Great Escape. He's a phenomenal actor, and yeah... I'll go ahead and spill the beans now, but I did not realize that that was Donald Pleasance until very late in the episode. And I feel like I felt very silly about that because it just went way over my head. And as soon as it clicked together that that was Donald Pleasance, I was just like, I was kind of blown away because I was really enjoying the performance. I thought the performance was out of this world incredible. And then when it clicked together that, oh, this is an actor that I'm a huge fan of through various things. It just kind of clicked together with me that's why it just clicked together with me. I'll talk more about that in the review, but I'm kind of gushing over him now, so I'll move on. Also appearing in this episode as the headmaster is Liam Sullivan. This is his second of two Twilight Zone appearances. We previously saw him in The Silence, which again is one of my absolute favorite episodes of this entire series. So it was good to see him pop up again. Also appearing in this episode as Mrs. Landers is Philippa Bevins. This was her only episode of The Twilight Zone. And then the cast also includes Tom Lowell as Artie Beechcroft. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone. However, he did also appear in a 1965 episode of The Loner by, you know, Serling, titled The Kingdom of Macomb. Russell Horton plays Bartlett. This is his first of two Twilight Zone appearances. Next we'll see from him is in season five's In Praise of Pip. And then rounding out the cast is Buddy Hart, who plays Dickie Weiss. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone, although I did find it really interesting. I think that he's credited as Buddy Hart in this episode, but elsewhere in his career, I think it's Buddy Joe Hooker. But he is a stunt person, stunt driver, stunt coordinator. He's worked on a ton of stuff. Like he worked on The Fate of the Furious, Free Guy, the Independence Day Resurgence, the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Deja Vu, and Vanilla Sky. I think he also worked on some other things that's not showing up on my notes. So I'm going to discreetly go over to the proper notes here, and then you guys are going to be none the wiser. So this is taking a lot longer than I expected it to, so I'm so sorry for that. He also worked on... Lost. That's what he also worked on, of course. So he was the stunt coordinator for Lost, I think. So that's pretty interesting. Very storied career. I believe he's still working today because, I mean, he worked on Free Guy, which was like a couple of years ago at this point. But really interesting just piece of information about Buddy Hart. Writer for this episode was Rod Serling, and director was Robert Ellis Miller. This was Robert Ellis Miller's only episode of The Twilight Zone. He did direct a lot of TV in the 50s and 60s, and he directed some films in the mid to late 1960s. So he did have a solid career and everything, but this was his only episode of The Twilight Zone. So with the talent rundown completed, let me go ahead and go into my thoughts on the changing of the guard. I'm going to go scene by scene, of course, and here we go. So it opens on like a placard or a plaque that's notating to us that it's the Rock Spring School for Boys, which resides in Rock Spring, Vermont. And it has the date that it was founded is like 1890 something, I think, or 1850 something. I'm not sure. But when I saw that, I thought like, okay, this is kind of reminding me a little bit of, this whole opening scene rather, really reminded me a lot of like the opening of Long Live Walter Jameson. And So that kind of led me to think that maybe this was going to be an episode about aging or time travel or what have you, especially with the notation of when the school was founded. I thought like, oh, he's going to time travel or something. So I was wrong. But I'm relieved that I was wrong as well, because this episode was fantastic. It was outstanding. So the professor is standing. He's you know, teaching to his kids, and he is talking about a poet named Alfred Edward Houseman, A.E. Houseman, and he reads, like, as he's kind of chiding the students, asking like when the poet was born and when he died and everything, and he's giving these kind of like these fun, like, comical responses or these kind of like chiding responses to him, to the students as they're answering him and everything. He then reads from a poem, When I Was 1 and 20 by A.E. Houseman. And he gives this is the first instance where I'm like, okay, yeah, this performance is phenomenal. Like, I think he does a fantastic job here, because he just has, there's so much heart in his recitation of this poem. And it just carries through, throughout the rest of the episode and everything. It's really good. It's really good. So that's a good performance from him. And he's very deeply affected by it. And then as he kind of wraps it up, he kind of says, like, since this is the last day of the semester, I can go ahead and, you know, dismiss you guys now, but I just want to let you know that, you know, I haven't finished, like, the exams aren't ready to be presented back to you or anything, but every one of you passed your final exams. And then he does this, like, wonderful, like, loving chiding of them, calling them all dunderheads, but nice dunderheads and perhaps fine young men in their own right. And there is this sentimentality to his speech to the class that makes it just feel so genuine and heartfelt. And there's this earnestness that is beautiful. And then the score rises with this just beautiful sentimental music that plays all of those emotions up a bit. But even without that music, it would still resonate, because Donald Pleasance gives a phenomenal performance in that scene. And so the combination of that and his speech and everything is just a really good way to bring us into the overall sentiment of the episode, and not only to demonstrate Fowler's love of teaching, but also to start building us toward that scene in the classroom where all of his, you know, past students or the students who have passed away are kind of giving him like thanking him for everything. It's just this is the first stepping stone toward that incredibly emotional scene later. So yeah, then from there we get Serling's opening narration, which I will go ahead and play now. So yeah, here is Serling's opening narration for the Changing of the Guard.
It is rare, young men, that in 51 years of teaching I have ever encountered such a class of dunderheads. But nice dunderheads, and potentially fine young men who will make their marks and leave their marks. God bless you all. Merry Christmas.
Professor Ellis Fowler, a gentle, bookish guide to the young, who is about to discover that life still has certain surprises, and that the campus of the Rock Springs School for Boys lies in a direct path to another institution, commonly referred to as the Twilight Zone.
So a couple of notes about the opening narration is I really like how vague it is and how all we know from it is the teacher's name and a couple little things about him. And at this point in my first viewing, I couldn't even begin to speculate on what the story was going to be about, and I was very excited about that. There was also an interesting, like, bit of ADR work, I think, in that opening narration that I kind of signaled, but it didn't detract from it or anything like that. Just, I believe in my research, I found that it was supposed to be a much longer narration, I think, or there was other drafts of it. And then it was cut down. So maybe that's the reason why it was a little bit ADR-y there. So I don't know. But anyway, Following the opening narration, we see Fowler walking through the hallway. He speaks to a few students. He's very friendly and everything. It's just showing that, you know, he has a good rapport with the students of the school. Then that's when the headmaster kind of stops him and brings him into his office and is basically like, hey, do you have a moment that I can speak to you? And so when they get into his private office, the headmaster asks Fowler if he says that he hasn't responded to the letter that the board sent him. And immediately from there, I thought, oh, okay, so are they forcing him into retirement? Is that what the story is going to be? And then the thing that happens is a great moment of Serling's writing. And again, that economizing of the plot that he does so incredibly well. But he presents this misunderstanding in their conversation. So the headmaster asks Fowler if he has, like, that he mentions that he hasn't responded to the letter from the board. And Fowler thinks that the letter is just the yearly renewal of his contract. But the headmaster obviously knows that it's a termination notice. So there then becomes a, that's really, really bad, like words. Anyway, then they have this little misunderstanding where Fowler says that he knows the content of the letter, thinking that it's the standard renewal and everything. And then the headmaster's like, oh, okay, good. And then Fowler says, yeah, you know, I'll go along with it, of course, it's fine. And so the headmaster in that moment thinks like, oh, this is going to make this conversation so much easier. This is much better than I was expecting. So the headmaster is kind of like, he kind of just brings it up, and he starts to say, okay, well, then this is great. We'll have to figure out your replacement and everything. But as he's saying that, Fowler interrupts him. And not having heard that part of what the headmaster said, Fowler just talks about how he was just telling his housekeeper that he wishes he could keep teaching until he's 100 years old. And he talks about how he recently spoke to the grandson of a former student and how it made him think that he may yet live to teach the great-grandson of a student someday. And he says all of this with this sense of wonder and this love and reverence for the job that he's done for decades, which is, again, such a great example of Serling's writing. Because in this moment, we now know, based on the headmaster's comment about Fowler's replacement, that he's being fired. But Fowler doesn't know that because he didn't hear the headmaster. So we are privileged. We have the privileged knowledge that Fowler doesn't have. So Fowler speaking with reverence for the profession that he thinks he's going to have for decades to come is really sad for us to witness in this moment. But it's also just exemplary writing because it is a character just bearing his soul for no other reason than he just has a love for the job, that he is just nostalgic for the past that he's had with the job and the future that he is going to have from his estimation. Yet we're seeing it from the perspective of the headmaster knowing that Fowler is not going to be teaching anymore. So there's just this level of resonance that comes through to the audience in such a way that I think that if it had been written any other way, so for example, if Fowler had heard what the headmaster said, and if Fowler and the headmaster were on the same page in this moment, and Fowler then went on to say like, well, you know, I have so many more years that left in me that I can teach. I just met the grandson of a former student, and, you know, who knows, maybe someday I'll be able to teach the great grandson of a student and everything. That would come across as him pleading and appealing for a different outcome and everything. But since he is just working under the assumption that, you know, he has his renewal letter at home, and he's in this nostalgic state for, you know, the semester is passing and everything, so it's the holidays, and he's just thinking about how, you know, how much he has, contributed to you know, his profession and everything. So that just makes it so much more personable and so much more genuine than if he was to be pleading his case to the headmaster to keep his position and everything. And like that little tiny thing, that little tiny element of Serling's writing makes a whole mess of a difference to the context of this scene. And I think that it's a brilliant piece of writing, or a brilliant moment or a decision to have that, those characters have that misunderstanding. I love that. Also, very embarrassing on my part, as Fowler is talking, again, I did not realize that it was Donald Pleasance. So I was like trying to think, like, he looks familiar. And I thought, like, was he a character in The Howling Man? Was he like The Howling Man? But no, he wasn't, obviously. As Fowler is kind of reminiscing about teaching, he obviously doesn't grasp that they're pushing him out and terminating his contract and everything. So there's just this sense of sadness that is kind of overcoming the scene, in a very, you know, natural way. And the headmaster then just finally explains that the letter wasn't a contract. It's a notice of termination. He says that we decided at our winter meeting that perhaps a younger man, and then he kind of trails off, and then he switches gears, and, or not even switches gears, but he refocuses and says, like, you know, if you could have been there, if you could have heard the things and how highly everyone spoke of you, like, everyone thinks you're a teacher of incalculable value, to us all, but at the end of the day, the youth must be served. There needs to be, you know, some new blood brought in, and a changing of the guard needs to take place. And so Fowler, he gets up to leave, and to that character's credit, he does not really make a fuss about it. He's in shock. He's very much processing what's going on and everything. And like the only thing he says, and it's draped in this dreariness and sadness, is that he says that, well, I guess this proves that, you know, a man should read his mail. And like, that's the only thing that he can say, because he's slightly attempting to make light of the situation, or to take away some of the shock and the negativity of the kind of aura of the room that he's in. But he's so distant, and he's processing what's going on and everything. So even that, like, little shred of, like, not even comic relief, but just lightheartedness, or not even lightheartedness, it's really just deflecting from the complete change up or the complete curveball that's been thrown to him. That just is draped in the sadness that we have for him as someone who we've followed for a couple of scenes now, and he is someone who is a respectable, you know, person. And we're already getting this level of resonance through his character. I just think it's really good. So Fowler leaves, and then two students see him and wish him a Merry Christmas. And, you know, they call him old Whitebeard or something like that, as a term of endearment. They don't call that to his face. It's kind of a thing that they say later. But anyway, he is talking to them and trying to keep his composure, and just his performance is incredible. Like, it's so just layered. There's so much going on in Donald Pleasance's performance. I just love it. So as he leaves, the students notice, and they seem affected by it too. And that's showing us that he does have an effect on his students, and that they do respect him, which is a great, it's a great stepping stone toward, you know, the more bleak elements of this episode, and that big emotionally poignant moment with the spirits or what have you of the dead students. But the thing that I didn't catch until the third time I watched this episode, but I love that this also is setting up the end scene where the students are caroling for him outside of his house, which I'll talk about at the end of it. But like, when I was watching the episode to make my final run of notes and everything today, I was just like kind of just blown away by that, because I didn't realize that, I didn't realize the connective tissue of this opening scene, or this first, not opening scene, but this first scene with the students, and how they notice that he's sad and that he was crying. in how that relates to that end scene with the carolers, which I'll talk about when I get to that point. But we then see Fowler at home, and he has a gun in his desk. So he's contemplating suicide, and honestly, that is a turn that I was not expecting at all. Like, I did not expect this to take such a dark kind of turn for this episode. I just thought that I was just shocked by that. And so his housekeeper comes in and tells him that dinner will be ready soon. He says he's not hungry, and he was listening to music and looking over old yearbooks. And then he starts kind of just waxing nostalgic about his past students. A lot of them, if not all of them, are ones that, we'll see later in the classroom and everything. So I just like that he has these memories of these students and everything. And at that point, I was just like, okay, so this is kind of about aging, sort of, but it's also having this nostalgia bend to it. So I didn't know exactly what the Twilight Zone element was going to be, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But I was very much invested in it because of Donald Pleasance's performance and just this air of nostalgia and reverence that he has for his history with the students and everything. So it's even when it takes this bleak turn, it's still very engaging and compelling to me. And then it does take that bleak turn because Fowler then slams the yearbook shut, and after he's kind of talked about past students and everything, and he says that he's a failure and that none of the students grasped what he was teaching. He taught by rote, he moved nobody, he motivated nobody, he left no imprint on anybody. And he says that he was a failure, an abject failure, and it's just so sad. It is incredibly, incredibly sad because we have this man who has spent 50 years in this position and loving it. And then suddenly the rug is pulled out from under him. He is suddenly facing termination and he is reflecting on it and he thinks that he has failed for half a century. And that is just, I think that the writing is beautiful. Like, I'm getting a little teary-eyed just thinking about it because I love this character so much, and we're seeing his darkest moment. In light of his termination, this is his darkest moment. He's contemplating suicide, and the spirit of his past students are what rescue him from that, and it's incredible. So I'm getting ahead of myself, but basically, he goes to take a nap, and then the housekeeper finds a key in the drawer and sees that the gun is missing. So she runs to the stairs to call for him and sees that the door is open, leading us to believe that he is left to go kill himself. And that's when we get an act break. So at this point in my first viewing, I was, again, really surprised at the dark tone that this episode takes. I thought that the first act introduces the character in a situation very well. And again, I still didn't realize it was Donald Pleasance. So in my notes I have, and the actor playing Fowler has a really strong grasp on the sadness of the character and the regret that he has. And the other element of this at this act break that I really appreciated was I really liked how the episode is just slowly getting us to the Twilight Zone element of the episode. It's taking its time, it's prioritizing Fowler as a character, and the show is giving him the proper emphasis so that when that Twilight Zone element is introduced, which, mind you, at this point, I didn't know what the Twilight Zone element was or could have been, it would be something that would complement Fowler's character arc rather than drive it and the episode. And so, like, just that's in my notes from the first time I watched this episode after the first act break. And like, I'm blown away by it because that's exactly what this episode does. This episode introduces a Twilight Zone element that complements Fowler's character arc rather than driving the plot and everything. And I was just so, so into it. So we come back from the act break and Fowler is at the gravesite of Horace Mann, who was an educator, and engraved on the kind of, the underneath the bust of it is the quote, "Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity." So Fowler is looking at it. He says that he's won no victory and now I am ashamed to die. So that's when he takes the gun out and points it to his own head. And that's when the school bells ring. beckoning him. And in my notes I have, here we go, let's do this. So Fowler is confused by that. So he goes into the school. It's obviously empty as it's kind of the middle of the night. It's nighttime, but the bells are still ringing and they're loud. So he goes into his classroom and it's empty, obviously, because it's, you know, nighttime. And that's when the students appear. And at this moment, I thought, because I was still kind of clinging to the idea that maybe this is about aging and it's about nostalgia and everything and kind of going back, because I thought for a second, I thought like, oh, is Fowler de-aging too? Does he look younger too? But he didn't. It was just, you know, the kids are there. So the boys all look at him in unison, and that's when he addresses them and says like, hey, boys, forgive me, boys. I'm sorry that I didn't, like, basically getting out that, you know, he's sorry that he failed them. And then so one student gets up, it's Artie Beechcroft, and introduces himself. He says, Artie Beechcroft, second whatever, class of 1941. And I thought it was interesting that the name Beechcroft, and Artie Beechcroft in particular, because it reminded me a lot of, I think it's Archibald Beechcroft from The Mind and the Matter. So it's just interesting that, you know, it's very close to that. But Fowler remembers him, and no, okay. So before I get to Beechcroft's moment with Fowler, this is where in my notes I put, holy crap, that's Donald Pleasance. So I don't know. I thought that was hilarious that it took me that long to realize that this was an actor that I have been a fan of for a long time. And in my defense, he has a lot of makeup on. Like they had to do a lot of makeup, as I'm going to say in the trivia, but you know, whatever. I just thought it was funny. So I wasn't aware at this point, I don't think I was, that he did a Twilight Zone episode at all. So it was just really exciting when all that clicked together. And now the distance in his performance for me in that first viewing was clicking together in my head. And it's just like I'm noticing the little elements of Donald Pleasance's presence in his delivery of lines that I had just seen that is really informing, like why I was so interested in his performance, because he's a great actor and he's an actor that I've seen a bunch of times in the past. So yeah, I was just really excited about that. So Fowler says that he's delighted to see Artie Beechcroft and that he's missed him, and he tells him that he shouldn't be there. And at this moment, Artie shows him the Medal of Honor that he had that was awarded to him posthumously. And I am just like blown away by it. Like I just immediately clicked over. It's like, I'm loving this episode. And for a couple of reasons. First, at this moment, Artie's showing Fowler the Congressional Medal of Honor that was awarded to him posthumously. So what the episode appeared to be about at that moment in my first viewing was that Fowler being shown that he did have an impact on his students' lives and the world indirectly. And that is just so great and lovely. And like in my first viewing of it, I was nervous that, like, I was so committed to this premise at this moment in my first viewing. I was so committed to it that I became nervous that it was going to end with him dying and like his like past students who have passed away ushering him into the afterlife, and just making sure that he was satisfied in the life that he lived. I would have hated that because I was so invested in Ellis Fowler as a character and his growth and realization and recognition of the work that he's done over decades, that I would have been furious if he would have passed away at the end of this episode, having lived a life worth leading and everything. So that was one reason why I love this episode. The other one is going to just be a fanboy kind of thing. If you guys know, I do Tower Junkies. It's one of my other podcasts. It's all about Stephen King and the Dark Tower series. So I'm a huge, 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 huge Stephen King fan. And the other reason why I immediately took a liking to this episode when it revealed what the Twilight Zone element was is because it's another episode that I can kind of draw a connection with Stephen King. I feel like Stephen King, either directly or indirectly, I mean, he's a big Twilight Zone fan. There's a short story in Stephen King's 1978 short story collection, Night Shift. It's called Sometimes They Come Back. It was adapted into a movie with Tim Matheson and a bunch of direct-to-DVD sequels that wasn't good, or like direct-to-video, I guess, at that point. That first one's really good. And the short story is incredible. The short story is about a teacher who is haunted by students that start appearing in his classroom that have a connection to a traumatic thing from his past. So I was just excited that I could have like another thing that I can be like, oh, I think Stephen King may have like used the Twilight Zone as a little bit of inspiration, but it's a loose connection at that, obviously. But I just wanted to shout that out there. So I also reviewed Sometimes I Come Back on Tower Junkies some time ago. You can check that out on towerjunkiespod.com. So Fowler then says to Beechcroft that he's proud of him and that he was always a fine young man. And just like that, that's beautiful. It's beautiful. And then another student gets up. This guy's name is Bartlett. He's from the class of 1928. He explains to Fowler that he died after getting leukemia when he was exposed to radiation as he was working on different techniques for x-rays and medical stuff for cancer research. And Fowler says that he's so proud of him for what he did. Like, I'm starting to get like a little teary eyed just because this run is like, I was weeping when this was playing. Like today I was weeping. So thank you, Rod Serling. You made me cry on my birthday. But I was like very teary eyed because this is such a beautiful and resonating moment in this episode. Is just so great. But Bartlett quotes a line that Fowler taught him from Howard A. Walter. He says, "I would be true for there are those who trust me. I would be pure for there are those who care. I would be strong for there is much to suffer. I would be brave for there is much to dare." And he says that this is something that you gave to me, that Fowler gave to him, that he carried with him. And it's just, it's beautiful. I have tears in my eyes right now. But then Beechcroft comes back up and he says, like, that's why I brought the medal with me, because it's partially yours. You, for everything that you taught me, this belongs to you as well. Because you taught me courage and what it meant. And that's what he was able to do with like being in war and everything. And then at this moment, I paused and I was just like, this is such a profound episode and it's definitely working on me in that first viewing. Then the tears start coming as the third student comes up and he introduces himself. His name is Dickie Weiss. I think Fowler says like, oh, Dickie Weiss. He tells him like, yeah, you were the first one. You were the first one to die. And he says, yeah, I died at Pearl Harbor. Jesus. I'm trying to get through this without crying because it is so emotionally just, it is warming my heart so much. And it's so emotionally resonant. It's beautiful. So Fowler says like, yeah, you saved a dozen men. Because Weiss says that he died at Pearl Harbor, and then Fowler says, like, yeah, you saved a dozen men from being trapped in a boiler room. You know, I'm really proud of you and everything. And then he says, you were at my elbow that day, Professor. And he then goes on to quote John Donne from No Man Is an Island, where he says, any man's death diminishes me, but I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Bartlett earlier quoted, I think he earlier quoted Howard Arnold Walter from I Would Be True. He said, I would be true for there are those who trust me. I would be pure for there are those who care. Oh, I already read that, didn't I? I did, because I almost lost it when I said I would be brave for there is much to dare. Okay, I just have it double in my notes. But anyway, that is just beautiful. It's wonderful. So then the rest of the boys stand up and we get a kind of rapid fire as Fowler goes down the line and each one introduces themselves and tells them what Fowler taught them. So we got Thompson, class of 1939. I died on New Guinea, but you taught me about patriotism. Rice, class of 1917. I died of wounds at Chateau Terry. You taught me about courage. Hudson, class of 1922. You taught me about loyalty. Walton, class of 1951. You taught me about ethics and honesty. And just the rapid succession of that, Fowler is just overwhelmed. And he goes back to his desk to kind of like sit down and compose himself and everything. And that's when Beechcroft says, "We've got to go back now, Professor, but we wanted you to know that we were grateful. We are forever grateful. Each of us has in turn carried with him something you gave him. We wanted to thank you, Professor." And that's where I'm weeping. That is where, like, I'm keeping composure right now, but I just thought it was just such a lovely moment, and it brought me to tears when watching it. And then that's when Fowler hears the bells again and the boys all kind of disappear again. Fowler's crying. The sentimental music comes up. It's really lovely. It's beautiful. And the episode could have ended right there. They could have ended it there. The episode could have had like a small denouement, then closing narration from Serling and call it a day on season three. But we get the follow-up scene, the actual denouement scene of the housekeeper on the phone telling the headmaster that the professor is home, he's okay, he's safe, it's fine. And Fowler is watching the carolers outside the window. And they're all current students. And at first I'm like, that's really sweet, that's really nice. But not until I rewatched it a couple of times did I realize that it's such a great closing of the, like a closure to that, to that early scene with the kids noticing that he was distraught and he was upset and he was crying about something, because they banded together, his students banded together to sing carols for him and to cheer him up. And that is such a great conclusion. And a great callback to that scene in the hallway with the students realizing that he was upset. And it's also a great conclusion to the overall sentiment of this episode, specifically because it shows that it's not just the dead who have learned from him. Like there is an additional sadness to the fact that the spirits that visit him are all, you know, students who passed away. All of them were, you know, died in war or died trying to cure cancer, like all of these noble efforts and everything. And so if we didn't have this scene with the current students caroling for him, there would be a read of this episode that would just be like, okay, yeah, that's really beautiful, that's sentimental and everything. But I mean, like, how bleak is it that so many of his students have died over the years and everything? But here we have the kind of salve to that, in terms of it being current students who are showing that they've learned from him and that they care about him. And that is just such a perfect button to this episode. It's so great. I love it so much. So Fowler is finally eating dinner and he's telling his housekeeper that he's going to be okay about with retiring and that he feels like he's done his part. He quotes that Horace Mann quote, and then he says that he's had a very full and rich life. And he says, "This particular changing of the guard, I wouldn't have it any other way." My voice cracked so much because I'm fighting back tears throughout this review. And I feel like that is causing me to my voice to crack a little bit. But anyway, that's the end of the episode. We get Serling's closing narration, which I will play right now.
"Well, I didn't win the victories, Mrs. Landers, but I helped others to win them. So perhaps in some small measure, they are victories that I can share. I've had a very good life, Mrs. Landers, a very full life, a very rich life. This particular changing of the guard, I wouldn't have it any other way."
Professor Ellis Fowler, teacher, who discovered rather belatedly something of his own value. A very small scholastic lesson from the campus of the Twilight Zone.
And there we have season three of The Twilight Zone. The finale is finaled. The season has seasoned. We're done with season three. And this is such a beautiful and poignant episode to end the season on. It is wonderful. Wonderful. Anchored by an incredibly heartfelt and emotionally resonant performance from Donald Pleasance. It is immaculate. I absolutely adore this episode. So that's my review of The Changing of the Guard as I'm fighting back tears throughout this entire review. I have some trivia here. So just a few pieces of trivia is that, as I alluded to earlier, Donald Pleasance had a lot of makeup put on him to appear much older than he was at the time. He was actually 42 years old, which, like, as I'm like reading that, I'm like, oh yeah, well, he's kind of up there. But I, like I said before, this is my 37th birthday. I'm very close to 42. Jeez. Anyway, the quote that Professor Fowler reads on the statue's kind of base, the actual, I think, I don't remember if I said it or not, but it's "be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity." I did say that. But the kind of behind the scenes trivia of that is that it's the motto of Rod Serling's alma mater, Antioch College. I may be mispronouncing that. I apologize. And it was spoken by its first president, who is Horace Mann, at the college's first commencement address. And following this episode, after this episode, or after completing the script, Serling accepted a teaching position at that school. And that's awesome. And I think I read in Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic that he eventually just didn't really have a good taste for teaching, or he didn't really take to it as well as he thought he would. So then he went back home. And also another piece of trivia is that this is the final episode of The Twilight Zone where the ending shot rises upward, which I find is pretty interesting. So I'm curious how that's going to play out in seasons 4 and 5. Another piece of trivia that's kind of loose is that Ensign Dickie Weiss was killed saving the lives of 12 men who were trapped in the boiler room of the USS Arizona during the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. In Westinghouse Desilu Playhouse episode The Time Element, which was the unofficial pilot for The Twilight Zone, of course, which was also written by Rod Serling. In that story, Ensign Janoski was killed on the USS Arizona during the attack. And as I'm reading this, I don't remember if they said the USS Arizona when Dickie Weiss was talking about his death. I don't know. Obviously, this episode is set around Christmas time in the show, but the show itself was aired in June, season finale. Which I like. I know that Night of the Meek is like the only episode, the only Christmas episode of The Twilight Zone, the only Christmas proper episode. But I would say that this kind of has a little bit of a Christmas feel to it, like with the carolers and everything. I would say it's an honorary Christmas episode of The Twilight Zone. And the final piece of trivia I have is that the basic plot of the episode is very reminiscent to James Hilton's classic novel Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which I am not really that knowledgeable about, so I'll take trivia's word for it, basically. So, overall thoughts on The Changing of the Guard. I loved this episode. I think it tells such a beautiful, beautiful story, and it gives this sense of accomplishment and absolution to this character who, in his darkest moment, has receded into the depths of the darkness within him, that he may not have done enough or may not have done his job properly. Now that it's being taken away from him, he does not think that he has left a mark and on the world. And just by virtue of this Twilight Zone element that comes into his life, he learns that that's not the case. That is, it's a very optimistic, very, very beautiful ending, and I adore it so much. So So yeah, so those are my thoughts on the changing of the guard. Let me know what you thought about it. Of course, I'm going to wind down this episode with a brief non-spoiler review of The Green Bomb, which is from season 2, episode 4 of Science Fiction Theater. And to bring us into that, I'm going to play the Science Fiction Theater theme music. So here we go. So, The Green Bomb originally aired on April 27th, 1956. The synopsis, according to IMDb, is using stolen parts, a psychopath builds a nuclear weapon while government agents race to find him before he can detonate it. This episode was directed and written by Tom Grease. There's also a story by credit from Ivan Tors. And this episode stars Kenneth Toby as Frank Davis. This is his second of two science fiction theater appearances, and he also has credits in Night Gallery, season 3's Finnegan's Flight, and one episode of the 1980s Twilight Zone, season 1's A Day in Beaumont, and he also appeared in The Thing from Another World for more sci-fi stuff for his filmography. Also appearing in this episode as Dr. Maxwell Carnovan is Whit Bissell. This is his second of three science fiction theater appearances. And in terms of other sci-fi anthology and credits to his name and everything, is in science fiction credits as well. He was in one episode of Out There, which was a short-lived 1951 sci-fi anthology show. One episode of One Step Beyond in 1959, which was season 2's Brainwave. And he also appeared in one episode of The Outer Limits from season 1. The episode was Nightmare from 1963. He also appeared uncredited in the 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And he also appeared in Target Earth, which I believe I covered in a very, very early episode of this podcast. And also 1960's Time Machine, which I believe I also covered in the episode where I reviewed... I don't remember if I did or not. I think I'm confusing it with Time After Time. But anyway, Whit Bissell was never on The Twilight Zone, but he did appear in Playhouse 90's The Comedian in 1957, written by Serling and covered by myself in an early episode of the podcast. And he was also in 7 Days in May, which was written by Serling and covered by me and Tiny. In I think the end, like post season 1 or season 2 of Anthology. And he also appeared in one episode of The Loner in 1965, titled An Echo of Bugles. And the rest of the cast, we have Robert Griffin as Ralph Scott, second of two science fiction theater appearances. And then rounding out the cast, we have Charles Maxwell as Shaw. This is his fourth of six science fiction theater appearances. He was also in one episode of Twilight Zone in an uncredited voice role in season 5's I Am the Night, Color Me Black. So this episode is okay. It is a little upsetting to me. The opening, the pre-show of it, and I don't want to get too much on a soapbox here, but the opening, the pre-show episode, or the pre-show, like, demonstration in this episode is such a 1950s thing. It is, I do respect it for kind of playing into the kind of atomic fears and research and everything, but it just left such a bad taste in my mouth because Truman Bradley is in a lab with a microscope. And he's making references to past experiments, like showing, like talking about when he had a monkey that was able to use a typewriter or something. And the, I think maybe from earlier this season or late last season, a scene where the snake was blindfolded and was able to attack the balloon. So like, that's cool. It's interesting that they used, you know, past footage and everything. But then he opens this, like, container and brings a dog out. This very, very cute beagle out, and he says like, yeah, this is a dog. He's a lab worker in atomic radiation. And I was like, oh God, oh no, what's going on? And he says that, like, you know, dogs like this, they can survive and live full lives with after being exposed to high levels of radiation, with treatments like shielding of the spleen and a bunch of medical tests and everything and medications and everything. And I'm just like, oh my God, I don't want to look at trivia for this because I don't want to be incredibly heartbroken to find out that this dog died from a horrible, or that any of the dogs, like any dogs, died of horrible, like, radiation poisoning because of, you know, because of this, because of research like that. It really, really rubbed me the wrong way. That also showed beetles that had survived radiation exposure. That kind of creeped me out, or grossed me out a little bit. But that's the pre-show. I was pretty disappointed, and it really made it put me in a funk for watching this episode. And the episode itself is fine. Let me go into it. I'm not going to spoil it, of course, but basically the kind of introduction to the actual episode proper is that there's this nuclear facility, the International Electric Corporation funds it or something. It's like research in nuclear physics and radiation and nuclear weapons and everything. And so the introduction of the episode has a bunch of stock footage of scientists working in this massive complex, and then we have the introduction of the protagonist, who I thought was the protagonist, but he's introduced in voiceover by Truman Bradley, that he's the only man who can work with the materials and work out how everything works. He is an invaluable resource and everything. And before that, in the voiceover, he had mentioned that all the scientists working at this facility are loyal to America. So that kind of puts into this perspective, this idea that, okay, well, in the moment I thought, like, oh, okay, well, it's the 50s. It's trying to, you know, just make sure it's not too scary for audiences who are living through the threat of nuclear annihilation and everything. But then it's also putting the seed in there that, okay, this doctor has access to everything. And so what if he's not loyal to the US? What if he is someone who is unstable? So then it's introduced that he has, like, full access to everything. And so then we get the next scene with the two men who are talking behind closed doors about Dr. Carnovan. And they're questioning, like, should he have unrestricted access? Because he has been acting irrational, and he's been blowing up at people. He's had a short fuse, no pun intended. And that's cause for alarm, that maybe we should restrict some of his access. And then the other man is like, well, you know, he is the person. He is the center of all of this. And this whole project, everything that we do here, all the research is his baby. And, like, we can't just restrict access. So there's a moral dilemma there. And then we get a scene with Dr. Carnovan, who he's working with scientists and assistants, and it's showing that he is a bit ill-tempered. He's a little bit testy with people talking to him and everything, and he's very aggressive toward them. And then this next scene, and then I'll stop, like, going through the plot and everything and share my just overall thoughts, but we have the men from before come in and say that, you know, we're going to have a psychiatrist in just to evaluate the personnel and everything. And I thought that this was kind of funny that Carnovan's reaction is like, oh, okay, we're going to bring in the thought police now. And I was just like, whoa, okay. He doesn't want to be distracted. And then this felt so shoehorned in, like, this next moment, a big part of this plot that just seems so disconnected from everything is that a beagle escapes from the lab, and he's heavily irradiated. So they, like, the whole complex needs to find this dog. And, like, I feel like that was something that was just shoehorned in. That's like, okay, we'll have Truman Bradley do this whole, like, talk about, talk about the dogs being tested for radiation sickness resistance and everything. And then instead of building an episode around that premise, they just shoehorn in this beagle storyline that is complete, like, it is secondary to everything. Like, it does not connect to the main plot, like, at all. Just to appease that opening, that pre-show experiment and everything. I just thought that was kind of funny. But what goes on from there is that people say that Carnovan is more and more suspicious. I won't give away what happens or how that rectifies itself or how it resolves. But I was very engaged by the ending of this episode. I think that there's a slight like twist in the plot that isn't necessarily what I expected, but it was really pretty satisfying. It goes into why Carnovan has been so aggressive and testy with everyone and has such a short fuse and everything. And it also plays into the kind of morality at play with what they're doing, with what the Atomic Age is bringing in the shadow of, you know, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's something that I found to be pretty, pretty interesting and intricate and compelling. And there's a nice bit of like humanity in this episode that I really appreciated about it. So those are my thoughts for Science Fiction Theater, Season 2, Episode 4, The Green Bomb. Again, it is available on dailymotion.com, and it's available on YouTube as well. Links in the show notes and everything. Of course, you can find those show notes at anthologypod.com/101, which I failed to mention this, that I was very tickled by the fact that the 101st episode of this podcast on the main feed, not counting the bonus episodes because I have a different numbering system for that, but I just love the way that it's just like episode 101 is covering an episode of The Twilight Zone that's about an educator. So I found that to be a nice a nice little coincidence and pretty fun. So okay, so once again, I apologize for the delay in getting this episode out. I just fall by the wayside, like busy, everything. But I'm so happy that I was able to get this out and everything. Before I start on season 4 of The Twilight Zone, I do have a few things that I'm going to do assuming that I can get everything in place and everything, but I'm hoping to get Brandon Cruz from Submitted for Your Approval on the show to do an overview of season 3, just kind of talking, shooting the breeze about the Twilight Zone season 3, as is customary with the first two seasons of the show on this podcast. And then I'm going to do a special Outer Limits podcast crossover episode with Victor Gamboa, where we're going to talk about actors who appeared in both The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. Very excited about that. And then I'm going to also have Tiny on from The Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies, my other podcasts, to do a review of The Rack, which is a 1956 movie written by Serling, as is kind of customary for post Twilight Zone seasons on the show. And then after that, I'm going to start season 4. Really don't know what to expect in terms of how I'm going to connect with season 4, because I know that they're hour-long episodes, and it's pretty, pretty heavily maligned in the Twilight Zone fandom, so very eager to see that. But also, in addition to that, I'm going to do a bonus episode review series on season 6 of Black Mirror, 5 episodes. I'm going to have a lot to say about those episodes. I'm very excited. Once again, if you do want to hear my thoughts before those, please check out Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. I have immediate reaction recordings for that season. That's Patreon exclusive. I'll probably put a clip from that in the kind of closing of this episode to give you guys a little taste. But check that out, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. I'm going to start playing myself out. Very grateful to you guys for supporting me and listening and everything. It's just, again, it's so nice, especially with, like, today's my birthday, and I've spent an hour and a half plus prep time just making this for you, because I love doing this podcast. So anyway, thank you guys, and I'll see you in the next episode. And now, enjoy this short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. For the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, such as early access to episodes, TV, book, and movie reviews and reaction recordings, commentary tracks, and Patreon potpourri episodes, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy. At several points, there were moments where I was like, I was on my edge, the edge of my seat this entire episode. And there were moments where I thought that I knew where the episode was taking me. And I was even in those moments, like toward the end, and I'll talk about this in the full episode, of course, but even in those moments where I was certain I knew where the episode was heading, like I had in retrospect, the most obvious idea of where this episode was going to go down, the road that it was going to go down. I was like, okay, this is exactly what it's going to do. I'm certain that this is it, and I'm all for it. I think that would be really cool, really interesting. It's a little cliched, but also this episode has referenced other, like, sci-fi stuff, and, you know, maybe that's to prepare us for the cliched ending. It's not a cliched ending. The ending, I'm a little bit back and forth on in the immediate moments of after watching the episode, but I think that this is going to be something that it kind of grows on me, and it's something that I am very eager to rewatch and kind of really let settle in my mind and kind of figure out my feelings on it and everything, because holy shit, man, this was just such a wild ride. And it does the thing that I've championed. I've talked endlessly about how the thing that I love about science fiction in particular is the way that it is a backdrop. These concepts, these ideas are like the speculative fiction, the futurism and everything. In this case, an alternate reality, an alternate 1969. These ideas and backdrops in science fiction are used to amplify a story about humans, about human beings, human interactions, different levels of humanity and everything. And that is what this episode captures really interestingly.
This podcast was edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. You can find links to all of our shows at ObsessiveViewer.com/podcasts. For exclusive bonus content, including reviews, commentaries, and B-roll episodes, you can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.